Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and we have a return guest today under very special circumstances. It's a guy who I don't want to insult you by saying we look alike, but I'm seeing you've got the short hair, you've got the beard, you've got everything I've going on except for the gray in the beard. But we've got Haris Sultan. Haris Sultan is fresh off a ban from Facebook. Or actually, I think you're still banned, right?
Well, it's not really. It's not technically, it's not a ban. I think it's just a technical issue that I'm trying to get over, get it resolved soon. But anyway.
Okay, so I just got to say this. So before, when we had you on last, right, it was a very different situation. But today, Haris is the only Pakistani ex-Muslim atheist who is out there doing a very, very popular YouTube show. And he's got a very popular YouTube channel called Pakistani Mulhid. And that means Pakistani atheist. And he's doing this in Urdu. He's recently had a very high-profile celebrity who's not an atheist, but he's a Muslim, on for debates. You've done a couple of things with Alishba as well, right? It's you're hearing a lot about you, and you're going out there and you're doing this stuff in Urdu. So let's start with that. What made you decide to do this, to actually do things in Urdu?
Oh, well, thank you for having me on again. I think you kind of really overpraised me there. There's a lot of room for growth.
But so many people will agree with me. You have no idea.
My Urdu channel, its growth has been a lot more encouraging than my English channel, for instance, but I still have more subscribers to my English channel. But I noticed that most of the people were actually from India and Pakistan. So pretty much everyone was saying, now, why don't you make these videos in Urdu instead? And because me being a Pakistani myself, it would make more sense for me to try to target that audience. Although their purchasing power is not as good as the Western followers.
You got to pay the bills.
Yeah, you got to pay the
Zionists? Just to hook up with the Zionists.
Yeah,
podcast.
Yeah, you're lucky. I think I got to get to that level first. But your Zionist friends should actually support me more, because I'm actually doing it in the heart of the Muslim world.
Hey, YouTube, this is not hate speech. We're joking.
Yeah, we're joking. Yeah, I heard that. Yeah, that they have the software that actually picks up these things. But anyway, in Urdu we have this advantage where I can actually say a lot of other stuff as well, which doesn't get picked up unless. So a lot of my audience were actually telling me to actually make a channel in Urdu, so I can communicate. And a lot of people, native Pakistanis and Indians, don't actually, they're not really that good with English either. So they only pick up certain words and the title. So why not? I'm pretty fluent in Urdu, and I thought that'd be a good thing. And the subscriber count might be underwhelming at this point. I think somewhere around 8,000 or something, which is very small as compared to, you know, like the 1.4 billion people live there. So it can always increase, and I'm seeing a steady growth.
But Haris, you've had the videos themselves. I've seen the one that you did with Alishba. I checked it a long time ago, but it was like 30,000 views in just a couple of days.
The Abdullah Gondal one is which was probably the least polite video, where we were borderline making fun of the Quran or some silly stuff in the Quran, and that's had like 90,000 views or something. And it's still one of the most popular videos for some reason, even though it's like 6-7 months old now. Mm-hmm. So it is, I think, starting two things in people. It's obviously making people think. I've always been a firm believer that people, when they listen to an idea, which they have either never thought about it or they've never dared to think about it, when they hear it coming from someone who looks like them, who speaks like them, and then when they go home, or they when they're sleeping, these words that we're blurting out, they're actually resonating in their minds. And I've always believed that because that's how it worked for me. Like I would always think at nighttime, I'm trying to sleep and I'm trying to make sense out of things, and it doesn't work. And then you go, oh, okay, so why is he saying that? And they try to come back with a comeback, and then that doesn't work either. So I try to communicate or with them as much as possible, and I respond to common questions, and I think it's good. I think it's creating people to think and look it up. They get angry, they shut it down, but it's like a drug. They always come back. Same people I see who are very angry, they comment on every video, so they're still watching it. And I think that's what we're trying to do. Speaking with that celebrity that you were talking about, Hamza Ali Bhatti, is the biggest movie star in Pakistan with, I don't know, however millions of followers everywhere. But he's pretty big. He's as big as it gets. And I've had really good conversations with him. And even he wants to have more conversations with me. So so he just got married, I think, a couple of days ago.
He did.
He was busy there. And he wants to talk to me as well. And a lot of people, the good thing for him as well, a lot of people thought of him as just a pretty face who just doesn't know what he's talking about. But he's actually quite educated on our atheist arguments. So that was a good thing. But more you go into it, the problem with religious thought or the people who follow that religious thought is they can't agree on everything. So even those people who are on his side and who are praising him for shutting me down as an atheist, which I think he did a good job, and I want to talk about this as well. But so many things that he would have views, the infidels like me are not going to burn in hell. He doesn't believe in that because he believes in compassion of God, and he believes that this hell is just metaphorical and all. That's a similar kind of argument.
Yeah, then you can't really go against that, right? It's like when
everything that he said, I said, well, if that is the real Islam that you're saying, although I'm not buying it, I have no problem with that Islam. So go, more power to you, go into that and preach that Islam. At least we'll get a good, you know, soft, really cuddly version of Islam. And I know, I mean, your friend who's not here, he would have butted me in by now, but he would not have liked it. But I have no problem with that Islam. And that's the Islam that I call the reformed version of Islam. Even though it's a lie, to me, it doesn't make sense, but it still makes sense to a lot of people. But anyway, that conversation was more, that was my moment of Sam Harris, Ben Affleck in a moment, in a way, because I found him smarter than I thought he would be. But although I got a little bit of a hint off that, because a day before I spoke with him off camera, and I thought, okay, well, this guy is educated. But then also the other thing was like, because he's a celebrity, and then I noticed myself that I didn't have the... I don't know. I wasn't starstruck because I had never actually watched his movies, so I wasn't really.
But did you feel like you were subdued a little bit because
I think I was subdued a little bit because again, this guy is a massive superstar and he has this confidence brewing, and he's not ashamed or he's not nervous or he's not shy about speaking nonstop. So a lot of people said that I didn't interject him enough. I didn't put my points enough. So every time when I started speaking, I was like in a hurry to just put it all out there.
No, but Harris, there's another element here, right? So it's not just the fact that he's famous and you're conscious that you're speaking in front of probably millions of people who are going to want to check this out and watch it eventually, right? Mm. But it's also a fact that he can speak very confidently because he's going with the status quo, like what everybody agrees with. Nobody's gonna come to him and try to hunt him down or anything. But you, even subconsciously, you know, no matter how confident, how out we get, there's always this, okay, I am potentially speaking to an audience of millions of Pakistanis, regular Pakistanis. I've seen the Mumtaz Qadri, like, funeral, the funeral photos, right, with all those crowds.
Yeah.
And yeah. I can't, am I going to say exactly what I want to say, the way I want to say it, completely brazenly? The way that he can, to a certain extent, you know, you can't. I think that any interviewer would have that.
I don't think that was my case. Like I never give two fucks about. Oops, sorry. Can we use the F word?
It's a podcast. Yeah, you can. Okay. Armin is my usual co-host. And by the way, to everybody who's wondering where he is going to be back. We are geographically separated. I've mentioned this before. He's touring Europe and he's doing some amazing events there. So we couldn't schedule him together. So there's some solo episodes, but he will be back in September. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I don't think I get intimidated by all these people who would want to kill me. I mean, that group, Lashkar-e-Lebak, what is it called?
Tehreek-e-Lebak.
Lebak, yeah, Tehreek-e-Lebak.
It was Tehreek-e-Lebak,
that guy. Yeah. So, on their Facebook page, someone had actually posted, and they made actually a video off that, and we reported it, and it got stolen. And, you know, they have a very cool, catchy chant. I mean, I kind of like that, you know. Gustakh ki saza, sar tan se juda. And when everyone is saying, it translates to this, the blasphemer has only one punishment, he must be beheaded. So when hundreds of people are chanting that in unison, it kind of, there's something cool about it, but definitely nothing cool about the words. So they had put my photo on it. They had put my photo on it, and they were saying that, okay, Gondal and I, you know, we're blasphemers of the worst kind, and we should be bad. So that doesn't intimidate me in that sense. I gave up worrying about that a long time ago. But I think it was just a celebrity power that because I thought about it. A lot of people said that did Harris get starstruck or whatever it was. For some reason, I did a lot of thinking about it afterwards. And I thought, okay. And even he messaged me, I think in the second talk, he did say that he read all the comments that Hamza speaks a lot more and it doesn't let Harris speak. So he said, I will try to let you speak on equal terms. And then we did that for first 30 minutes, and then he went back to his normal routine. So I think I still think I made my point, because my point was that nothing he said that was convincing for me. So people who are supposed to be atheists, who are supposed to change their view in a way, I mean, that's what eventually we try to do, right? When we as proponents of a certain idea, we want people to agree with us. We don't force them to agree with us, but at the end of the day, that's what we want. Like, okay, listen to my idea. You might subscribe to it, and that's what we want. So I don't think anyone who is an atheist who listened to that talk agreed with, you know, said, okay, well, I found Islam, because, you know, whatever Hamza said made sense to me. On the other hand, I saw a lot of people who's supposed to agree with Hamza, a lot of Muslims, because we know how dynamic that group is. They were not agreeing with half the stuff that he was saying. You know, like infidels like themselves don't go to heaven. And I remember my sister told me, oh, he shut you up there. And I said, no, he didn't really. And then I said, well, he also said this. And she said, yeah, I don't agree with him. I said, okay, so he's, whatever his thought process is, it's very enlightened thought process that he has. And I've, as I said before, I've got no problem with his Islam. I don't buy it. I mean, we still go back to the original.
Well, he's a Muslim who's better than Islam. I would think that, yeah.
Yeah, but he doesn't think that. I mean, it's, again, the same problem with selective reasoning. Yeah. And anyway, so,
you know,
so it was a good chat. The point I wanted to very quickly make, that started a chatter in Pakistani circles. There's Oria Maqbooljan. He's a religious nutbag, but he's got a huge following. He's a mainstream journalist and everything. And he actually held a program right after our chat. I haven't watched it yet, but people told me about it. And where he was just explaining what atheism is and how atheism is rising in Pakistan and blah, blah, blah. But he didn't name you or me or Muhammad Saeed or Abdullah Gondal. I think us four are probably the only ones who are still actively speaking. And me and Gondal being...
the males, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but we're the only ones who are speaking in Urdu, and we're very outspokenly out, you know, like we're not hiding behind a face or, you know, behind... anything. So he didn't name us because, you know, he didn't want people to look us up. But I think it's starting something.
But you know what? So this is what's selling. This is how I put it together. So you're talking about Oria Maqbooljan, right? This guy, like nutbag. I know him. He's oh man, there was, I can't even get into all some of the stupid shit he said in the past. But in any case, and he didn't want to name you for a reason. Okay. And that reason is the same reason that no matter what happened in that chat with in your talk with Hamza. This is a good thing. It always is a win. And I'll tell you a quick story that Noura Mbabi, who's this sort of she's an Egyptian American ex-Muslim. She used to run Muslimish before. She told me, and she has she used to wear hijab, right, her whole life. And I think it was a neighbor or a cousin or something. She wasn't wearing her hijab, and she went there. And the neighbor, cousin, whatever, there was a little girl, young girl, who wore the hijab. So she went in, and then
she saw a picture, an old picture of Noura, where Noura was wearing hijab. So the girl looked at her, and she's like, "You used to wear the hijab?" And she said, "Yeah, I did." And she's like, "You don't now?" It's like, "Yep, I decided to take it off." And she just left it at that. That was it. Right? And I can't stress, in my experience, having done this for over a decade now, I can't stress how powerful just that is. Right? Just the idea. It's like a Rosa Parks. You know, like, remember Rosa Parks?
Yeah.
Move to the back of the bus. No, I'm not going to move to the back of the bus. She didn't even say anything. She just refused to move to the back of the bus. And that's a powerful moment. Sometimes just by example, the fact that there are going to be a lot of kids, and you know this, you've heard this on the record and off the record from a lot of people in Pakistan, even the ones who are religious, right? There's loads and loads of atheists over there. Everybody knows a bunch of them. There's almost like a little bubbling movement happening. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people, they're going to watch it. They're going to see Hamza talking to you. And the content of what you say is not going to matter. The fact is, they're going to see, well, Hamza Ali Abbasi, this big movie star, is sitting there. He's talking to this guy who doesn't have horns. He doesn't have fangs, right? He doesn't look like Shaitan. He's smiling. He seems like a regular guy. He looks like my cousin or my uncle or my brother or whatever. He's an atheist, and he's saying, "I don't believe in God, and I don't believe in Islam." And that itself is the most powerful thing.
That's what I was taking it out from that as well. And I was taking the fact that, okay, it's kind of legitimizing the actual discourse because, you know, like, simply, like, for example, Oria Magbul is scared. He would never engage with an atheist. He wouldn't even name them because he knows that, you know, this bubble could just blow out of in his face or the face of the ideology that he wants to promote. So he wouldn't even do it. But a big movie star like Hamza Ali Abbasi, when he does it, they go, "Oh, okay, it's a legitimate conversation. This is just two dudes just talking about ideas." Mm-hmm. And I don't agree or I agree. And I think even the points that I have made. I mean, people, the intellectual level of the education of atheistic arguments in the Pakistani mainstream society is just so poor. You know, like, I mean, when I speak with an ordinary Westerner, it's like, you know, it's probably because of this societal makeup has led them to this way of thinking. That, you know, like, you just simply blurt out, like, just say, you know, like, who created God, if everyone created God. They've already thought about it. They've already spoken about it. But when you speak to a Pakistani Muslim or Indian Muslim or something, they always give back the same similar problem, the first causal problems, you know, like, where do you think the trees and the planets and the birds came from, you know? So these are educated people who could be doctors, people who could be, you know, high-ranking officials in the government or a bank or something. It's like, it's just fascinating to me that they just never really. It's a tragedy in a way that never even thought about. They just never had the freedom to even think about it or contemplate against the position.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a you know, but I just think there's so many elements of this. I think the fact that you have this is considered a debate. It's like, first there were Muslims, and then the atheists were these like little underground people who just chop, you know, they don't say anything, all this stuff. But now you have like Muslim, atheist, two sides, they're going at each other and they're talking and they're having a discussion that legitimizes it in a way where the content of the conversation doesn't even matter. It's not even fine. You're an example. Someone looks at you and says, okay, but there's also the fact that this conversation is happening and it's happening on equal terms. The stature. So that's very powerful. And I think another recent example of that, and I know a lot of people are pissed off about this. There is a little bit of a divide, is that Armin. So I was having this sort of like Twitter back and forth with Ali Dawa, just because he's so much fun. So Ali Dawa, for those people don't know, is a sort of super religious YouTube Islamic preacher who likes engaging in debates. Oh yeah, convert from what?
Well, I'm assuming it was just Christian or something. I don't know, but I actually in that video
he said he used to be secular. That's all I know. I just don't know. Right. Okay. But I don't know if he was what his family background is. But either way,
he said when I came to Islam, he was in that conversation with Armin, he was saying, well, when I became a Muslim. So I don't know. I thought maybe he was a convert. Yeah.
No, he says he was an atheist or a secularist before. this is something a lot of people say. I always take a grid. I'm sure he's
being honest, but like a lot of people just kind of nowadays.
No, no, no. So I think this is the time when we actually say that he thought that he was atheist. You, but the same thing they actually say that about us, which is obviously false when they say that to us. But in their case, it's actually true when they say that. I can actually legitimately, confidently say, no, you were actually never an atheist, because when you go back to the same problem, okay, I get it. We might, you know, we get stuck in this, you know, like at an intermediary philosophical problem, you know, the first cause versus, you know, where did everything come from, what caused the Big Bang, blah blah blah. So, you know, all that, so you can, the most you can take is an agnostic position, and which I always say agnostic atheist, that okay, we don't know. But so if you're educated on that, you cannot just straight away jump into all these interests that the God
revelation
and how
angels
how you should have sex and all that. So all this shit, this seems so petty. So that's why, I mean, when people say I was an atheist, I didn't think they actually were. They were probably indifferent towards religion, like they were just living the life. They just didn't care about it enough. So that could be it. So they confused that with educated atheism.
Yeah, there's a sort of, I guess it's a byproduct of this identity politics. So I remember when I posted that on during Pride, yeah, I posted that, you know, that picture of the Kaaba with the rainbow cover on it.
That went wild.
It's a very nice picture. And then what happened was that, you know, there were loads of people responding to it. And one of the most common responses was, I am an atheist too, but this is just insulting. Or I am actually Christian, but I'm not. But none of them are. They were all like, they're all trying to give it legitimacy, their argument legitimacy. Just to, but in any case, so Ali Dawa is. We had a bit of a back and forth, and then he said, come on now, and let's do a talk." And I was like, "Okay, let's schedule it." He didn't want to schedule it. He was trying to get out of it, and then eventually, Armin went to Speaker's Corner where he was in London, and then he ended up having this long conversation with him. And after that, they went to dinner. There's a picture of Armin, the founder of Atheist Republic and the author of Why There Is No God. And then I think Faye, one of our previous guests here, also a feminist activist, ex-Muslim activist, Jimmy Bungush, LGBTQ, you know, gay, British, Pakistani, ex-Muslim, sitting there with Ali Dawa and one of his friends. And to me, that was a very powerful picture, because that's not just going to be seen by our ex-Muslim community. That's going to be seen by all of his fans. And they're going to react to it. Some of them are going to be pissed off. Some of them are going to be like, okay, it's good. You're engaging in dialogue. That's what Dawa is supposed to be about. Whatever the conversation is, there's going to be a conversation. Because now, this is two sides. It's not like one big prominent voice and the other people are like little critters under rocks. It's two sides actually sitting there and talking. There's a legitimacy to it. And again, the content of what they talked about at dinner or whatever, it's completely irrelevant. The important thing is the exposure for people to know this is an option. Yet, when I was growing up, right, and we talked about this before, I think when I was growing up, I didn't know there was conservative, like Saudi style Muslim, and then there was liberal Muslim, like my parents. When the Salman Rushdie thing came out, I was like, this isn't even a fucking option. Like, you can't, like, what are you doing? You know, you can't write shit about this stuff, and that's not even an option. You can be a conservative Muslim, you can be a modern progressive Muslim, but you can't be an atheist, right?
Yeah.
And now that there are kids who were like I was back then, there are kids now in that position who are looking at it and they're saying, okay, so there is an option. And this is a legitimate option because look, one of them is talking to Hamza Ali Basi. The other guy is like hanging out with this like YouTube preacher who's with hundreds of thousands of followers. This is a different thing. This is bigger. And
I see this. I see this actually on very similar lines. And this is how I see it as a market. You know, like this is a market which is, you know, 90% audience or 98% of audience or people. That's your market share. At the moment, it's only 2%. So you have. You have nothing but to gain from it. I mean, more you get out there, more you hang out and speak with these more famous people. Because we got to get out of our bubble as well. You know, like, fine, we've done a good job. We've created an ex-Muslim community. Or I don't even like to see it like that. But, you know, but we are probably known in a lot of ex-Muslim circles. But that's it. You know, that's a bubble that we have. So we got to go out there and we got to explore the new world out there. And you know, it's like spreading them. It is kind of like an atheism dava in a way.
That's what we did. Like when we switched, you know, this podcast was originally called Secular Jihadists from the Middle East. And it was, there was four of us. And then when Armin and I went with a new format and we called it Muslim Enlightenment, one of our resolutions and our goals for the new podcast was like, okay, you know, we've done this whole thing, the new atheism thing. Everybody knows about Dawkins' tweets and everybody's seen all the Hitchens clips and everything like that. And yet I don't want to go to conferences and just speak to a whole bunch of, nothing against white people, love white people, but, you know, I don't want that to be my exclusive audience. The reason I'm doing this, I want to talk to Muslims. And, you know, I did that at the University of Toronto. Actually, the University of Toronto came up with a great security measure because when it was announced, the University of Toronto in Mississauga, where I did the Snyder lecture last year, when they announced it, and this wasn't like a group that invited me, this was an official university lecture that they call an author every year. And, you know, the one that they called the year before was Trudeau's mom, like the prime minister's mother. She wrote a book. So it was a very high profile lecture. And the students were very upset because Mississauga has got a huge Muslim community. They did not want to, they had a problem with my social media stuff and everything. So I asked them about security. And then they proposed this, that they're like, you know, we don't feel comfortable in a university with checking bags and doing all of that stuff. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to have our Islamic studies professor come and do a 5-minute rebuttal to you after your talk. And he's going to launch the Q&A. And I was like, that is brilliant. That's excellent. So I'm going there and I'm doing a talk. And suddenly, like, I go there and 1/3 of the audience is Muslim kids, students. An Islamic studies professor comes. We have a great talk. The Q&A got extended by half an hour. It was just an amazing discussion. Lots of Muslim kids came up and they asked questions. And, you know, the security thing just got completely, it wasn't even an issue. It was now sort of a two-sided thing, right? And so we started doing that. Armin and I, we got Daniel Hakikaju, who's like a very sort of hardcore conservative Muslim. We had Asadullah Ali Asadullah. I don't know exactly how to say his name. We've had recently a guy who wasn't
Andalusia,
exactly. And then we had this guy wrote to us recently, and he said, "Listen, I'm a lay Muslim. You guys talk about lay Muslims. Well, this is what lay Muslims think. This is what, like, I'm not necessarily educated in Islam, like, in a lot, but I know what I think. I believe in the spiritual part of it. I want to talk about that because we are the majority, and I want to sit." And I thought that was really interesting, and we had a really good conversation with him too. And this is what we got to do, man. I mean, you're doing this, and that's what I love you for it. And, you know, Armin is doing this, and, you know, Gondal and Abdullah Samir and these guys are really, really engaging. And I really like it. I think that this is the next step. This is the next step that we have to engage with our own.
Yeah, I think the Urdu content is very important, and this is why, let's not forget Sharif Gaber, what he achieved in Arabic. I mean, his audience was entirely Arab people who were listening to him Arabic, and he built a huge audience. I don't know, half of them probably hated him or not, but I reckon this BBC study that we were talking about, I think Egypt had a pretty big jump as well, from 10% to 18% or something, or I think over 20%. I don't know how much of that probably goes.
Now that you mentioned it, let's talk about it. And I do want to mention that I think two episodes ago we had Mohammed Hisham. Mohammed Hisham is the Egyptian atheist who had that famous TV clip where he was thrown off an Egyptian TV show, and he was essentially called a psycho. Get your head checked. And he said, "I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist," on Egyptian national TV. And then he went home. He was beaten and everything. Now he had to get out of the country. Thanks again to Troy Garnott, who helped make that happen. And also Armin, Atheist Republic, Sam Harris, all these guys sort of helped. They had a part to play. And now he's in Germany. And we did a whole episode with him. If you haven't heard that interview, you should. He also came out. He's gay. So gay and atheist out of Egypt. And he spoke to us from a refugee center.
I think I'm meeting him in Berlin. I've got a tour event coming up in Berlin. I think Armin's going to be there as well. And yeah, I think he's going to be there. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to meeting him.
Right. So anyway, so the article that Harris was referencing here is a BBC article from June 23rd, 2019. It's called, this is the title if you want to look it up, The Arab World in Seven Charts, Are Arabs Turning Their Backs on Religion? And some of the information here, the stuff that they talked about, first of all, it's about an increase in atheism in the Arab world. But some of the stats are actually quite stunning if you know the context. And I think that's what we'll get into. For background, the last major poll that I saw like this was from 2012, 2013. And that's the one that I've quoted before, too, where they looked at the number of atheists across a whole bunch of different countries, non-religious. And they found that in Saudi Arabia, 19%, and this was done by Gallup, which is a reputable international polling organization, 19% of the people in Saudi Arabia said that they were non-religious. In contrast, that same number in Italy was 15%. And then 5% of people in Saudi Arabia said they were convinced atheists, not agnostics, not non-religious, but convinced atheists. That's the exact terminology, which is the same percentage as the U.S. Saudi Arabia has a population of about 26 million people. That's well over a million people in Saudi Arabia that are confirmed atheists. And even more, about a fifth of them non-religious. This study found a very similar kind of thing. So they found that since 2013, I'm reading from it, it says, since 2013, the number of people across the region, across the Middle East, Arab world, identifying as, quote, not religious, end quote, has risen from 8% to 13%. The rise is greatest in the under 30s, so people under the age of 30, among whom 18% identify as non-religious. And only Yemen saw a fall in the category. Yemen's the only place where people are getting more religious, but in the rest of the region, 18%, that's almost a fifth of people in the Arab world under the age of 30. And this is where the context is.
And very, very important, very on that Yemen point, I think it might have something to do. I've discussed that whole process in detail in Lebanon and in Pakistan, where there have been conflicts with religious conflicts, and how we've seen that there is an increase in religiosity under war circumstances. Mm-hmm. I'm just assuming here, because that was the case in Pakistan. I've written that in my book. If you haven't bought it, please make sure you buy it.
Harris's book is called an excellent book called The Curse of God. The Curse of Dog, I was going to say. The Curse of God, right? And it is I read the entire thing ahead of time because I wrote the foreword. So thank you for that honor. And it is really a really great book for anybody to read, especially if there's any ex-Muslims listening. Yeah, go ahead.
So in the book, I actually trying to explore the idea of how there was increase of religiosity in war zone areas. And with Yemen, I'm just looking at the stat that it went from 11%, it fell down to 5%. So the religiosity increased in Yemen. I'm just assuming how much of that was probably related to the ongoing conflict that Yemen is having. And the point that you made about Saudi Arabia, yeah, that was 5%. But that the key point that and I wrote that in detail in my book, and Pakistan's got 2%, which translates as 4 million people. But the key point here is that study was done in 2012. Now, we're living in 2019. You might say, well, it's only 7 years ago. But the world is changing so rapidly that historically, before that, the number was 1% in 2005. So historically, they've been doing it every 7 years, Gallup. So I don't know
Look at this. This went from, since 2013, went from 8% to 13%.
And that's
across the region. That's the overall. So if you can, and you have to remember that a lot of atheists in Saudi Arabia are not going to want to talk to polling agencies. They're not going to trust these motherfuckers. No. I mean, they'll say that we have every reason to believe that these numbers are underreported. And moreover,
in Saudi Arabia, atheists are tried as terrorists. So that's why they have terrorists. And on that note, in Tunisia, for instance, I mean, Ali just said that it went from 8% to 13%. So that's an increase in 5 percentage points in 6 years. But the encouraging thing is in Tunisia, it went from 11% to 30%. It's like 30% of Tunisians.
Tunisians are non-religious.
They're non-religious. So it doesn't say convinced atheists, but non-religious. So the religion plays absolutely no part in their lives. That is very encouraging. Same in Libya, it went from 9% to 23%, I believe. Yeah. And Morocco is another one. I don't know if Mimsy is making a difference there. So it went from 2% to 10%. So it's quite exciting. We're living in a very exciting time, I'd say.
And there's here's a kicker, and this is going to be if you're not excited enough just yet. When they say the rise in the under 30s, among whom 18% identify as not religious, that's one fifth of people under the age of 30 identify as non-religious. About 70% of the population across the Arab world is under 30. Okay, so you also got to let that sink in. The vast majority of people there are under the age of 30, and this also includes Iran. It also includes places like Pakistan. It includes across Saudi Arabia, Egypt, all these. They're very, very young skewing countries, right? Under 30 skewing countries. So considering that one fifth of that population, I mean, you can have a pretty good idea of the kind of trends and the time. Well, I mean, there's headlines and there's trend lines, and this is also a really important distinction when you want to read behind the headlines and what's going on. So, Harris, you mentioned, for example, that in Saudi Arabia, atheism is a terrorist crime, right? Atheists are considered terrorists. That law came about in 2014.
Mm.
Now, think about it. That law is the cause of a lot of problems. It's causing a lot of problems to be for atheists in Saudi Arabia. But what is that law the effect of? Why in 2014 did Saudi authorities suddenly think, shit, we have to have a really severe law for atheists. We got to do something because there's something going on. They know this is happening in Iran. They're cracking down on it. In Malaysia, they're going after atheists. In Pakistan, the blasphemy and the apostasy cases, all these things are going through the roof. This is a reaction to something that they know is happening. So even if you don't have these poll numbers, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, there's something pretty amazing happening there. And this is what I mean. You know, when we call the show the Muslim Enlightenment, I really feel like there's something very significant happening that, you know, what the printing press brought about in Christian Europe, you know, as Mariam Namazi says, the internet and social media is kind of fostering a very similar dynamic in the Muslim world.
Yeah, and it's the interesting part here is Pakistan's a little bit different. So Pakistan's not really as theocratic and as totalitarian as Saudi Arabia or Iran. So that's why I think it's going to be a bigger challenge for Pakistan. And it's obviously got bigger audience, a bigger population as well, with 220 million as compared to what 20 million in Saudi Arabia, and Iran is what 80 million or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's why I think it's going to be very interesting. And there's no law against atheism in Pakistan. How they get you is blasphemy. So it leads to that, because if you do say, hey, I don't believe in God, you ask why you don't believe in God, and whatever you say, that can be held against you as blasphemy. So and the recent case of Asia Bibi, she was released. What I do know, the prime minister is the prime minister of Pakistan. He is quite sympathetic towards the rights of minorities. And again, he recently, when he toured the United States, he spoke about the Ahmadi community, which is the most persecuted community in Pakistan, more so than atheists as well. You know, the shops that say dogs and Ahmadis are not allowed in here, sort of like how it used to be in the 50s in America about colored people, so to speak. There is a realization. And I'm only going to speak for Pakistan, because with Saudi Arabia and Iran, I only read the headlines, or just, you know, the whatever is happening on the surface. I don't understand the dynamics of it as quickly, as deeply as I can say that about Pakistan. And Ali, you obviously being Pakistani as well, so you would know that too. That the mood is probably changing, and the Pakistan, when it comes to Pakistan, you cannot ignore the what we call establishment, which basically means the army that runs the country and it has a huge influence in the country. Sometimes it gets overly exaggerated as well. I mean, the civilian government does have a huge role as well, but they're kind of always working cahoots with each other. So they, army is more worried about it. And this is the dissidents, some of the dissidents who were actually hunted down by Pakistan state in 2017. Even they have said that they were hunted down more so because of their criticism for the army rather than criticism for Islam. So they're also more concerned about consolidating their power. They're more concerned about how people are talking or viewing or the so-called propaganda against the army rather than they are concerned about Islam. They are concerned about Islam. The blasphemy law is still there. And it is kept awake in the hearts of ordinary people by the whole establishment. And the media speaks about Islam with so much respect and care. The Pakistani celebrity that I spoke with, even he told me that, okay, I've got no problem with you criticizing. And he also spoke once in favor of the Ahmadi community, and he was shut down on his, he had a mainstream program on the local TV, and I think he was attacked quite aggressively. So there's definitely something happening, and there are very liberal politicians who never come out and never speak as liberally as they should, as we would like them to, and we hope that they would get some courage from us. So it's very interesting time, and I think Pakistan might lead the way because it's not as totalitarian as the other two countries. It's got more dynamic population, bigger population. And it's going through a little bit of a transitional phase itself. Is it democracy is evolving and all? So I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of to talk about with Pakistan. I mean, one of the interesting things is that for the first time, I mean, you know, Pakistan was established as a democracy, but every time the military came over and they took over the civil, it's like Egypt in that way, where the military is sort of independently powerful, and they're actually more powerful than the civilian government. But recently, you know, it really was, I think it's only happened twice so far in all in the last decade that there was a peaceful transfer of power from one civilian government to another. That has not happened in its 70-year history until very, very recently. So that's a big thing. The democratic process is messy. Fortunately, it's a little bit more enduring. So I kind of share your optimism. There was a time when I thought that nothing was going to happen to Pakistan, that it was essentially dead. It was a failed state. But
not even long ago. Like, I mean, I think last time I spoke with you, you were quite pessimistic about Pakistan. And
I was. Yeah. And I think I'm on board. I mean, I was pessimistic about Imran Khan, the current prime minister, as well.
There you go.
I still, obviously, he's not perfect, but considering the alternatives and everything, you know how it is. And
let me tell you this. And Hamza is not my source. There's some other people that I've spoken to as well. Everything I say something, or people say, oh, he must be getting that from Hamza. There's a couple other politicians I've spoken to as well. Imran Khan is actually, even though he talks about, because he's got his own very twisted, weird view of the world, and he talks about the state of Medina. I'm going to turn Pakistan into a state of Medina. And
I think that's brilliant. I'll actually talk to you about why I think that's strategically brilliant.
Yeah, go ahead. I think it's brilliant too. Well, not really. But
I'll tell you why. I have no qualifications.
I think I know what you're going to say, but anyway, we'll argue on that too. But so he's got his own twisted view of, I'm going to turn Pakistan into a Medina, state of Medina, you know. But the state of Medina that he's talking about, that's not the state of Medina historically, and that's not the state of Medina you and I see. So, I mean, I always say, I want to ask him, do you want to bring amputation of hands, stoning of adulterers, throwing of homosexuals, or whatever? Maybe they would say, well, throwing of homosexuals is not a Sayyidi, or whatever. They're going to argue, but it's a very totalitarian kind of legal system. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, putting that aside, he is still very, very sympathetic towards minorities, towards atheists. He has heard of Abdullah Gondal and myself. He has seen the popular video that I was talking about. It's got 97,000 views.
Imran Khan has seen that.
Yes. I know that very good. Abdullah Gondal actually let it out.
I've heard that too.
Look, I mean, I haven't spoken. None of us have spoken with Imran Khan, but the people who are telling me, they're very close to Imran Khan. So the point is, he obviously doesn't share our views, but he is sympathetic towards us. So towards atheists and towards, he spoke, I mean, after my conversation with
him. He's pro-engagement is what you're saying.
Look, he's a pacifist. He's not a violent person at all as well. This is why, like, when I see this Indian propaganda against him, that he's a jihadi and all that, and now Imam, I like Imam Tohidi a lot, but he's so anti-Imam Khan for some reason. I don't know.
We have to disagree completely on Imam Tohidi, but anyway.
But maybe you haven't. No, but he's been very good to ex-Muslims. He's been very good to me as well. So, I mean, there are a lot of I don't share with him. But I like. I mean, when someone forwards a hand of friendship to me, I don't spit on it. But well, maybe to seal it the old cowboy way.
But, yeah, I know. Oh no. Listen, a lot of people very very nice in person. There's great people who
Let's not discuss. So I'm talking about Imran Khan. So he. This is a very. After my conversation with Hamza Ali Abbasi, and I have been feeding him a lot of atrocities that have been happening against minorities in Pakistan, the Hindu conversions and Ahmadis and all that. And Hamza had already spoken in favor of Ahmadis a while ago, so it was no news to him. But the Hindu conversion is a new issue that is still being, you know, at first people react with disbelief that in my country, no, this cannot happen. We are better people. So this all exaggeration, propaganda, bullshit, the Hindus, mm-hmm. girls are not. So the legitimate disbelief, and I think he had that disbelief as well. And he thought that, he said that a lot of that is exaggeration. It's not that many. Some girls legitimately run away. And I said, well, you know, but we have one law for Muslims that they cannot convert. They cannot change their religion unless they appear in the court. So why not have the same law for other religious minorities as well, especially when they're 15 or 16 year old girls. So he kind of agreed with that. And after that talk, Imran Khan I think he came back after that United States trip. And there was a minority day in Pakistan. I don't know if it was global or it was just everywhere or if it was just in Pakistan. So he spoke and he raised the same points. About minority, he said that you know, like, I'm hearing that these girls are being kidnapped, you know, he said that in America. He spoke about Ahmadis. He said, well, there's one community that is, I believe, is being persecuted, you know, like he said, I'm not gonna name them, but there are a lot of things going on and I would like to, you know. He said that in his address to, I don't know where he was.
Capital One State, yeah, it was massive. Yeah,
no, not that one. It was to the American audience. It was in English. Yeah, it was actually to the American audience. So I can, and this is everything how I thought he would be. You know, I wrote an article when he came to power, and I'm holding that, and I want to see that how much of the prediction that actually turned out to be true. I'm still hopeful. That I think he's still going to be the best news. People are skeptical towards the state of Pakistan. Historically, it's been a shithole, unfortunately, for a very long time. So that's why there's a lot of skepticism. But I still think that this is the best thing that has happened to Pakistan in a very long time.
I'll agree with you. I mean, with the best thing, I mean, again, I don't think he's perfect. I am very skeptical, but I'm not cynical. Talk about Sadiq Medina.
He wants to bring...
So on that, here's what I think. So I saw his, you know, when he first got elected and he did that speech that he wrote on the back of all these other papers. I mean, it's he's very good that way in terms of being relatable. But I was listening to what he was saying, and I work in communications, right? Mm. And I'm very, very interested in demagogues, you know, populist people who go out there and just, they really, really know how to relate to what people's instincts are, and it can be used for good, it can be used for bad. I mean, Trump is, for example, a massive demagogue as well. But
Modi's a demagogue as well.
Yeah, one thing that Imran Khan said kind of reminded me of something my dad used to say. So my dad was, you know, he was a Muslim, sort of liberal, progressive Muslim, yeah. And you know, he used to say, well, you know, the Constitution of Medina, it's no different from the Constitution of the United States. That's what it is.
Only Western human rights. They stole it from the Muslims.
So now it's complete bullshit.
Everyone who grew up in the liberal Muslim family, they've heard they have adopted our values of humanitarian, looking
it's
after the
They are following the Prophet's example. It's all bullshit, though. It's not true. But
maybe
the
orphan part is true.
If you want to take Pakistan and you want to tell them, hey, listen, we need to be more like Norway and Sweden, okay? We need to be more like their countries. They're going to be like, you know, we need to be more like Canada. They'll be like, hey, westernize, you know, they're trying to westernize us. You know, we are Muslims. We are not Western. This is all colonization, all the shit. Yeah. But if you tell them, look at the public services, social services in Norway and the healthcare system in Canada. This is what the Prophet himself did in Medina. Yeah. This is Islamic.
So yeah. If you paint all of that stuff as Islamic, suddenly people will be like, yeah, why the fuck aren't we doing it? And so you can actually lead them towards, I guess, quote unquote, I don't want to say westernization, but modernization.
Yeah, I've heard that argument. But the problem is, I think he genuinely believes that, though. That's where the problem is. And I think he genuinely believes, and he's corrupting the minds of so many people who would grow up thinking that being humanitarian, well, I guess it will be side effect would be like, okay, at least it turned out to be humanitarian, even though on the back of a false Islamic history. Sure. I don't mind if even a rosy, cuddly version of Islam comes out. I would have not much problem with that. It'd be like living in a Western country where, you know, there's so many Bible preachers. They're harmless. They have absolutely no impact on your life.
And they're all pro-secular. They believe in the separation of church and state. Yeah. So
although it does fluctuate, the pendulum shifts a little bit, and we can see the rise in the, you know, like all these far right wingers always happen to be extremely, extremely devout Christians, you know, who are against abortion, who want to legislate against homosexuality, same marriages, all that. So there is always a risky element in there as well. So, but the Muslim world has to go through that transition. So, you know, it's not overwhelmed by the liberal people. Western world is overwhelmed by the liberal people with some fringe on the far right that is dangerous. But unfortunately, that's why I say Pakistani people are not really far right. But they're highly conservative people. Even the liberals are very conservative by the Western standards.
Yeah, I actually do. I don't think he genuinely believes that. I just think that just basic on the basis of his history, the stuff that he's written in the past, he was married to Jemima Goldsmith, right?
Yeah, but that was a long time.
He's got two kids. It was a different era, but I don't think and his sort of embrace of this born again Muslim thing sort of coincided with his political ambitions as they were evolving. And just like, you know, like Obama, I'll give you an example. Obama in 1996 put out this thing in support of LGBT, and there was a point out there that says, I believe that same-sex couples should be allowed to get married, and I'll oppose any legislation that opposes this. So he said this in 1996. He said it clearly, but when he started running for elections, he's like, no, it should be between a man and a woman. And then by 2012, he was evolving, and then he, you know, eventually came out with it when the support for same-sex marriage rose up above 51%. So there is he is a very astute politician. I don't think there's much of a point in even discussing this because there's no way we can read into his mind, right? Yeah, so we don't know whether he really believes it, but I have a different view on it. Harris, if it's okay, if you have something to add on that, that's cool. Otherwise, I wanted to actually move on to the Khuldoon article, if you're cool with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on to that.
So this guy, Kumar Khuldoon Shaikh, is just an absolutely brilliant journalist and very precocious to him. He's just in his 20s, a very young guy, lives in Pakistan. He's done some of the best writing and some of the best op-eds I've read in the past 6 or 7 years have been written by him. He's published everywhere. He's published in The Guardian. He's published in all of the major Pakistani newspapers, and he recently had an article in The Diplomat, right? And that's thediplomat.com, and the article is called The Defiance of Pakistani Atheists. He talked to me about this as well, and this is the crux of the story. It says, in a country where atheism is a capital offense, non-believers are still finding quiet ways to forge community. And what he's been talking about is recently in the last few years, there was a rise in a lot of these Pakistani atheists and agnostic groups. One of them was called the Pakistani Atheists and Agnostics. It was a Facebook group. And what's been happening recently is a lot of the stuff has been shut down. So it's the same kind of phenomenon that we're talking about, where all these governments are sort of cracking down on atheists. There were several secular bloggers and social media personalities that, you know, I think about a year ago, they were just hunted down. They were caught. They were just whisked away, you know, by the government. I unfortunately heard from some of them, and you know, some of them were tortured pretty badly, and they went through a lot of hell. There was that Ayaz Nizami guy. Remember him? Who was also a secular blogger, and Hang Ayaz Nizami was trending at the top of Pakistani social media, Twitter, and everything.
And when you click on their photos, who are tweeting about that, they look like everyday people. So this is what I meant by these are perfectly ordinary, normal people otherwise. But as soon as this blasphemy bug that has been planted in their brains after 70s, I think that's when he was reinvigorated, that law, although it has always been there, even from the British Raj time. But it just became such a big issue at that time. But as I said, the point is, and this is why I think that they're highly conservative people. And Ayaz Nizami note, I just want to get off topic just for a little bit. I'll take
Go for it.
Last time when I was on Secular Jihadist, I think I was at that time as well, coincidentally, I was speaking about this guy. We named him Spartacus. So we were trying to get him out of Pakistan. And thanks to the generous donation of a lot of people, we managed to get him out of Pakistan and we managed to fly him into Nepal. And now we're at the next stage. His asylum seeking application is about to be approved, and we're hoping, so once he's been given a refugee status, we then need to fly him to the only country that we're looking at where we can get him to is Canada, but Canada takes a 1-year bond kind of a thing, where it's kind of like an assurance of support kind of thing, that if he can't find work or something in the first 12 months, then, you know, instead of him being a burden on the taxpayers, you have to deposit some sort of a money, which is $15,000. We've secured $10,000, and I raised another GoFundMe campaign. I think we've crossed $3,500 or something. So we're still a little bit short, $1,500 something. So if you can donate, please go to GoFundMe, or just look up GoFundMe Spartacus or Harris Sultan GoFundMe. You will find that. So
dude,
if you
can send me the link, we'll put it in the description.
So and as Ali was mentioning Ayaz Nizami, and this is mentioned in the article, who these guys, there was a crackdown on these people. Spartacus was one of those people. So Ayaz Nizami was ahead of all these people. I don't know if I should say that, but well, allegedly he was the head of these people. So I don't know, but this guy Spartacus was one of the bloggers who was criticizing Islam, and he was criticizing the army, and then he was tortured. Those of you who don't hear know the story, you can go to my channel. You can watch the whole interview in detail. It was a very brutal detail. His own mother got a fatwa against him that whoever beheads my son will go to heaven without any questions. He was tortured. Wow. His finger was cut off. He's got his body full of scars.
So and they've hammered nails into their kneecaps. Yeah. That's the kind of things that they've been doing.
Not him, though.
Not him specifically?
To one of the other guys that did that. So he was on the run for 8 years until he heard of me, and then he contacted me, and then we started the campaign. And last time, as I said, I mentioned that in Ali's podcast, Secular Jihadist. Last time we were starting the campaign at that time, and we got funded. So please, if you can, help out this fellow atheist. Mm-hmm. Ali, go ahead.
Yeah, so what I was saying is that there's been a crackdown on this. So not only that, I mean, we have seen this with some of our content, that we have gotten messages from YouTube. Armin has gotten messages from YouTube that we have been, the government of Pakistan has requested that you remove this video. So this would not be viewable to people in Pakistan. People have heard that about individual tweets. There's individual tweets. I've tweeted things, and someone from Pakistan said, "Oh, this is, send me a screenshot. Tweet's not it's unavailable. What is it? I can't see it." And it's
remind me. There's a couple of really funny add-ons on that point you just made.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So what they did was they knew that. How was this happening? When they got these bloggers, I found out that. They were going through the friends lists of people on Facebook, including me. So I had to tell a lot of the Pakistani people who were following me, the atheists and everything, to unfriend me, to unfollow me, whatever it was, because it was actually a threat to their security, which is crazy because I think of myself as such a cuddly, like, I'm not wajib a qatl, I'm wajib a cuddle. I mean, that's what I'm like.
That's what you think.
I know that's what a lot of people would disagree, unfortunately. But the, I had this.
I'll cuddle you when I see you in Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah. We're going to see each other in Amsterdam. Well, we're going to talk about that in a bit, too. But so what they started doing is they started clamping down on social media because they knew this is where it was happening. This is how are all of these, like, fucking atheists in our country showing up. They're organizing, they're talking to each other, they're converting each other. It's happening on YouTube, it's happening on Twitter, it's happening on Facebook, it's happening on Instagram. So we're gonna go ahead and we're gonna really, really, with an iron fist, we're gonna smash this stuff. And they have been largely successful, and this is the unfortunate thing. And this is what this article talks about a lot. And I think you guys should all go and read it for yourselves. I can't read the whole thing here. But what they have done is now the atheists in Pakistan, usually they communicate through channels like WhatsApp, you know, stuff that's encrypted. Their communication has gone underground. We don't really hear from them in public anymore. They can't really post publicly anymore. They can't even access a lot of times the content that Harris, you might post or that I might post. They find their ways. When people want to find their ways, they do. But it's actually a really sorry state of affairs because there was a pretty dynamic sort of public-facing movement that was happening in Pakistan a while ago. And people might say, well, it wasn't such a big deal. It was just like a small group of people. You know, you're over-representing it. Well, if I'm over-representing it, if it was a small group of people, why would the government go after them so hard? You know, there's a reason that they went after them so hard. It's because it had a lot more influence than they wanted it to have. And this is, again, another reason why I think your conversations with Hamza Ali Abbasi are so important, the fact that you have that platform. And it ended recently. What happened? This one guy comes up and he starts a YouTube channel called Pakistani Mulhid, and his name is Harris Sultan. And he messages me a few weeks ago and he says, hey, I think it was a few weeks ago, it feels like it. Hey, they just took me off of Facebook and they didn't tell me why. Like all of your content just taken off of Facebook. So that's kind of what this article is about. And I want to talk about that. Are you concerned?
Yeah, I just want to talk about that. I think there will definitely be a blowback on us. They're not going to just lie, you know, walk away in the sunset and never come back. There's going to be very fierce resistance. At this point, as I said, the celebrities are aware, the televangelists know and they talk about atheism is evil and all that, but they don't mention people like me on name, but they know they're talking about me or people like me, but they won't know. So at this point, they're trying to contain it, and it's not going to contain. It's going to blow up in their faces. Once that happens, that's why I said I drew a comparison. I mentioned the contrast, the difference between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Iran. Those are more totalitarian. Pakistan has a little bit more democracy, and it's going to be very difficult for them to do it, especially when they're trying to plead their case against India for human rights violations while they're doing this. So everything in this day and age is going to blow up in the face. So they can't really get away with human rights abuses, especially, you know, if someone like me who lives overseas. And as I said, like some people in the government also, they don't think that the country as religiously held it is, it shouldn't be like that. So I actually also was quite angry when my Facebook was taken down. My Abdullah Gondal Facebook has previously been blocked in Pakistan, but again, 3 months later, it's popped up again for some reason. I don't know why. And same thing happened with my Facebook profile. It was blocked in Pakistan, just in Pakistan, but people everywhere else could see it. But I thought, okay, maybe I've been taken, but I actually received an email from PTA, which is Pakistan Telecom Authority, who actually looks into the blasphemous posts. I got an email from them from saying that when we request accounts to be deleted, we only request Pakistani's accounts to be blocked. But I think he didn't know, or whether I should tell them or not. I'm still a Pakistani citizen, but anyway. But when we request them to be blocked, we only block them in Pakistan. We don't have jurisdiction. We don't have control over asking Facebook to take it off altogether. And we had nothing to do with that. I felt it quite strange that this guy's pretty higher up. I thought about naming. I actually shared the screenshot of the email, but I took out his name because I didn't want. I thought maybe you know it could actually blow back on him because he actually said we didn't find anything blasphemous about your post. So I thought that could probably get him in trouble. That yeah. Maybe anyone can find anything on me and say, hey, that was blasphemous. So I didn't think I should use his name. So I didn't. But he's pretty higher up. So it's not like some rogue official sending me an email. Why do they have to explain that to me? I mean, are they really watching me? It's kind of freaky that they are watching me, but then they're still kind of like they're not threatening me. But you know, like I don't understand. So I actually did apologize in my last video. I said, well, okay, maybe I jumped the gun and I accused Pakistan of being behind it. I think it was just Facebook. And maybe it was just Facebook's own silly algorithm or something. But again, even in that case, it didn't make any sense to me because when I logged back in yesterday briefly, none of my posts were taken down. So usually, you know, when a complaint is made on a post, the post is taken down and you put a 30-day ban or if you are a repeat offender, that totally delete you. But none of my posts were taken down, or at least as far as I could tell. And
well, they took down your entire personal profile.
The disabled my account.
And your page.
Yeah. I think personal one, apparently it is against Facebook community guidelines to have multiple accounts. So as I said, I mean, for one of them is actually my personal, my real friends. Not that you're not real. I think you were added to my personal one as well. I don't know if you or not. So anyway, I
don't know. My Facebook is purely for public purposes. So.
Yeah. And that's what I'm thinking too. But I'm a little bit sad because that one is gone. Like my school friends and people I used to work with 12 years ago, everyone's gone.
So I have a personal one too, with family and friends. Yes, I think you're on it. I don't know. I don't remember. But if you're not,
well,
I'm glad you're.
I used to be probably because my personal one is still gone and I don't really care about it. So I was excited yesterday for getting it back, but then something else happened and it now is just like I forgot to update my phone number. They're trying to verify me through a phone number. I don't have the phone number. So anyway, so I think I'll be back on Facebook again. But my point was, I think it was just Facebook, not Pakistan. Pakistan only blocks people. And the point that you made about tweets getting blocked in Pakistan and YouTube videos getting blocked in Pakistan, look at the funny law of nature that now Pakistani audience, massive number of thousands of Pakistanis are going through that way. Their tweets are being disabled. Actually, their accounts are being disabled at the complaint of the Indians because they have complained to Twitter that these Pakistanis, pesky Pakistanis are just, you know, doing this false propaganda against India over the issue of Kashmir, which is a separate, totally separate issue. And I have my two cents on that as well, but I don't think it's the time to do it. But moreover, a couple of Pakistani ministers lost their account with the blue tick. These are ministers, sitting ministers. They lost their accounts. President of Pakistan got that default message from Twitter. We have received a complaint about your tweet, but we didn't find anything wrong, so we haven't taken any action. So one of the other human rights minister of Pakistani government, she's as useless as anyone can be. She was angry and showing her, showing how upset she was and Pakistani government was that our president is getting these kind of notices. I mean, how dare you at the complaints of India? So I think it was a very sweet justice in a way that I said, well, that's what you've been doing to a lot of people.
Yeah, it came home to roost.
Yeah. So
it is. It's very stupid. But you know what happens? Like a lot of this. So it's interesting in Pakistan, you've got the civilian government and then you also have, you've got the army, which is like an independent thing. Like they can afford not to give a fuck about what the civilian government's doing, even though they try to nowadays. And then you have the ISI, which is their intelligence services. And they all three of them tend to be autonomous in a sense. They all seem to have different priorities. There's obviously a lot of overlap. That's how the country runs, barely.
Yeah.
But there seems to be a fair amount of independence and you know, the fact that they all kind of run on their own. Now, what's interesting is that the way that they, I don't think, as you said, the army and all these guys, like they're worried about blasphemy, but I don't think they care about it that much. It's a very similar situation for different reasons as it is in Saudi Arabia. The way that Saudi monarchy is absolutely not religious. They use it for their benefit. They use it to crush political opposition. Now, do you remember when YouTube was banned in Pakistan for a couple of years? It was like 2012, 2013. I can't remember exactly when.
Yeah.
Some years ago. It was banned for a good like 2 or 3 years or maybe less. I'm getting it wrong.
Yeah. No, I think it was, you're right. It was about a couple of years. And then that's when YouTube came back. They came back with this clause that, okay, if you ask us to block something in Pakistan alone, we'll do that.
Yeah. So they had to, so it was like a compromise. And, you know, it's a tough situation for these just sort of big social media companies I don't know. I think it just got a lot bigger for them than they ever thought it would be. But it's, so what happens is that with the YouTube ban, that was triggered by around the time that the Benghazi thing happened, right? There was that movie that came out about the blasphemous movie from
Muhammad.
Muhammad.
It was a very poor taste, and the point was, I mean, they gave it more attention.
then yeah, it was a terrible movie. I mean, there's nothing, no problem with Vlasmin Mohamed. This was genuinely shitty movie. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I was looking at that movie. I was like, no, I don't know. I'm Muslim.
Not even
that's,
that.
that's the one time I wanted to be a Muslim. Yeah. I'm like, this is what atheists are producing. Okay. Yeah, I'm kidding. I never was Muslim.
It was just poor. Like, there's another one. There's actually another very good, well-produced cartoon kind of movie with Muhammad, and it's on the Muhammad and Aisha. That's a very I forgot that one. Yeah. So I mean, if you're gonna do something, just at least do something good. And I think that the same thing happened when the pastor said that he's gonna burn the Quran on one day or whatever. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But again, the world has changed a lot. That was 2012. Geez, where were the ex-Muslim open critics? But now they're everywhere.
Yeah, there was this. I'm trying to find the name of the movie. It was made by Nakula Basili, "Innocence of Muslims." That's what the movie is called. "Innocence of Muslims." So that was supposed to be a blasphemous movie. And what they did was they used that as an excuse to ban YouTube. Okay, because YouTube wouldn't take it down. So when Pakistan used that as a, I don't think they really cared about blasphemy. But what it, the thing with Pakistan is that if the government wants to shut down political opposition. Right, and this is the time, you know, Imran Khan was in power. Then there were like other people, Nawaz Sharif, Zardari, and all these guys. When they want to shut down political opposition, and if they say we want to shut down political opposition, that's why we're banning YouTube. The entire country would rise up in revolution. It'd be like, what the fuck are you doing, right? Because in Pakistan, the media and everything, they really really want to be able to say what they want to say. Like they are pretty loudmouthed, so. But if you tell them, like, if you tell them that no, we actually banned YouTube because of blasphemy, the entire population will be like, "Oh, okay, that's good. We banned."
I don't think it was because of that. Because the political opposition has always been very, very extensive in Pakistani media. I mean, the political opposition, the politicians have been throwing shit at each other for a very long time, so that has never been a problem. The Dawn leaks happen around the same time.
Actually, no, it hasn't. That only started happening during Musharraf's time.
I know that. So Zardari wasn't really doing much against, or he was a weak president, or that government was just as weak as anyone else's. So they weren't really able to, I don't think they were trying to shut down the political opposition, because still. Political opposition, there was plenty of political opposition in the mainstream media, print media, Facebook. It was everywhere. The problem happens. I mean, obviously, Zardari and the generals, they don't give two fucks about Muhammad or religion or Islam. They do everything that is un-Islamic. So it doesn't matter to them. They're probably shit. Whatever. So, but the problem, when people like Orion Makbuljan or the Zayed Hamid and these kind of televangelists, when these religious, when they come on TV and they say, "Hey, look, this is what's happening. Where is the government? Why are they not doing anything?" Then there's a shitstorm in the social media and everywhere, and people start demonstrating and protesting. And I think that's when they have to show to the world that, hey, we got it. The couple of stories about. The couple of stories about some major politicians who've done so much behind the scenes, but they're doing good things, but they cannot make it public because people will go after them. You know, supporting, like, for example, there was not long ago, I think 3 months ago, there was a Hindu veterinarian, that's how you say it, in Sindh. His clinic was burnt down in Pakistan. And he was accused of blasphemy. That's why it was burnt down by some Muslim. He gave medicine for this customer's donkey. He gave his medication in a piece of paper that was written in, there was Arabic written on it. I'm not sure if it was the it was from the Quran or not. Because even in that case, you'd think, well, how did he get the piece of paper from Quran? Yeah. So he must be actually doing blasphemy. So anyway, so there was Arabic in it, and he just made a noise. Oh, he had a Quran and he's giving me donkey medicine in that. And he went to his local imam and they came back in a horde, as they do. And they burnt down his own his clinic.
Was it a winged donkey? Did it have wings?
It was a normal donkey, but you can't keep donkeys away from, you know, from
a tough thing,
from fellow brothers. Yeah. But so anyway, so they came down, burnt down his clinic, and then this politician. I don't want to name him, but it's off record. So I'll tell you off the camera. But so he actually gave him 1.5 million rupees out of his own pocket and moved him, resettled him to another village and got everything restored for him. But he still can't name himself publicly that he actually helped him. And the local police actually...
Well, because of what happened with Salman Taseer, the governor of Punjab.
Was a politician.
There's an example. I mean, the governor of the largest province of Punjab, who was just one of the most powerful people in the country, was murdered by his own bodyguard because he went to a Christian woman Asia Bibi, and he declared solidarity with her, and he was murdered for it. And millions of people today still celebrate the man who murdered him. So if there's like any kind of politician that wants to help someone accused of blasphemy, they're going to look over their shoulder more than once to make sure the same thing doesn't happen. And I just want to say, we did have Shan Taseer, who was the governor's son, on this podcast as well. So in a previous episode.
And this is the state of it. So I think the people, politicians, army, they're all scared of this. And when I listen to Pakistani mainstream TV shows, the way they talk about religion, they're like, oh, okay, let's not go there. You can tell the host is a very, very liberal guy. He probably doesn't believe in that. But he's not even just turning. He's trying to avoid bringing religion into it. But that's why people like Oriya Mokbul and Zahir Ahmed are so fucking dangerous, because they bring in the hammer of their piety and their holier than thou attitude in that. And then they go, then you can't counter them, because they know if they counter them, that's blasphemy. So
it's blasphemy.
And people will jump on his side very quickly. So, I mean, there are people like Rauf Glasra, there's Kashif Abbasi. These guys are very liberal. I think they're borderline atheists or agnostic. But they stay away from it. Because hell will break loose.
Yeah, it's like it is in the U.S. I mean, the largest group, here, the non-religious group, the what they call the nuns, NONES, religious nuns, is one of the largest groups here in, well, not here in Canada too, but in the United States. But so you would think that they would be Australia more than
It happened in Australia as well. Last year we had a census. We 32 nuns of no religions, 32% here, which is 31, very close with, I think, 30 point something, which is Catholics. So
it
is.
In the U.S., it's about as big as the evangelicals, or I think even bigger. But the thing is that these people, I mean, the nuns don't necessarily politically organize as a group. And the other problem is that, you don't see, you would think, I mean, the government is a representative of the population. How is it possible that in all of Congress, only like maybe one or two declared atheists? Like, that's clearly bullshit. Like, there isn't I was pretty convinced that Barack Obama was an atheist. I mean, I think he is, because I wrote a whole article about it called Barack Obama Closeted Non-Believer, because if you read his book Dreams from My Father, he talks about how his mother kept him away from religion because she thought it was great superstition. His mom was an atheist, and then his father was a confirmed, his father was an ex-Muslim. Obama Sr.
When it wasn't even cool,
when it wasn't even cool, so he was from Kenya. He came to Harvard, and he was from a Muslim family. And then he wrote in his book, he's like, my father, by the time he came to the U.S., he was already a confirmed atheist. I mean, that's a quote from his book.
So how could two atheists give birth to a believer? I mean,
I know.
Very rare, very rare.
Yeah,
and especially if someone is so brilliant, who's so smart that he actually ends up being president. So, I mean, he could be bullshitting just because...
They have to. I mean, he bullshitted about the gay marriage thing. I mean, there's a speech he did from 2004, which is actually stunning, which he comes out and, he talks about, you guys, you're talking about the Bible and marriage and all this stuff, but which part of the Bible should we listen to? Leviticus, which tells you that, two people should be killed, should we listen to Deuteronomy? I mean, he skewered the Bible, and then they've... That clip is really hard to find, but I have it. Shipped it. I referenced it. They kind of scrubbed it from all over the place. But there's a lot of politicians. I think this is the thing. We're talking about the Saudi monarchy. Like, these people, they use religion because it helps them. I mean, you think that the evangelicals... Sam Harris tweeted the morning that Trump was elected, after Trump was elected, he said, the ironic thing, I'm paraphrasing, the ironic thing is that 81% of evangelicals voted for our first atheist president.
Right. Yeah. I'd buy that. It's actually true. He could be anything.
No, but but the thing is, they were smart. We were all making fun of them. These stupid fucking evangelicals. Why would they vote for this guy? But they were right, because now, you know, the capital of Israel has moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which it always was. But in any case, like officially, it's officially he's declared it. The Supreme Court, if he's reelected, you're looking at like a 7-2 conservative majority in the Supreme Court. That's a really, really good bet by the evangelicals. This is something Seth Andrews and I talked about. So some of you guys might feel like this is repetition, so I won't dwell on it for too long. But they use religion. A democratic, open society, secular place like the United States, they use religion. It's a big thing. They use religion in Israel, like, which is also supposed to be a secular democracy, apparently.
There's a very interesting book I just finished reading last week. I think it's called Siege. It's very funny as well. And it's a pretty deep insight in Trump's life. And it's absolutely fascinating. All his life, he was actually pro-abortion. And now he was just, you know, he even said that, okay, well, these people who are legislating against abortion, it's not going to work, is it? You know, because he actually wants abortion. The guy is like...
They asked him, like, have you ever paid for an abortion for somebody who got pregnant? He's like, no comment. And he was there's clips of him in 2012.
Whatever he says, Hillary. Yeah.
He does not have... I mean, there's absolutely no... Well, Trump's a different example because he doesn't have any kind of ideological baseline. He doesn't have any kind of moral compass. I mean, he has nothing. He's just he is a pure demagogue.
He lives in a moment. Whatever he sees at that moment is right or serves him, he changes it.
It's very impressive, but he is one of the purest breed of demagogue. Even Hitler had some sort of like ideological affiliation.
He was very strong with this.
Trump's amazing that. But in any case, I think that I think that they use religion. I feel like with Pakistan, we're gonna have to kind of see what happens. That we're coming up to time now. We've got about 8 minutes left. But what do you see? You've had this experience. So you've got a YouTube channel. You've been engaging with a lot of the Pakistani public, the Urdu-speaking people. They've been coming to your channel. You've interviewed, again, Hamza Ali Abbasi. You've been thrown off of Facebook. Yeah. How do you navigate this? Like, what do you do into the future? I mean, there are people who are being thrown off of these social media platforms and things like that. People are cracking down on quote-unquote hate speech and defining it any way they want. What do you suggest that people like us do?
Well, I would obviously ask people to support me on Patreon. that would be a great help, because a lot of things that we do, it's just out of my own time. And I have to, for a YouTube channel to grow, I have to produce something like at least 2 videos a week, which is very difficult for me sometimes to do it. As I said, I totally do it out of my public interest. I'm doing it as a public service. So my interest for serving the public, basically. So that's why I do it. So if you can support me on Patreon, that'd be great. But I think there's still a lot of room for growth. But what I have learned is that even though a lot of people actually keep coming back, so we build audiences. So I have audiences, so like some of the videos have been watched by my, that one video has been watched. It's a 12-minute clip where we just make fun of some really funny verses in the Quran, you know, me and Gondal, and it's got 97,000 views and still doing rounds for some reason. And people watch it, but they...
And this is an Urdu, right?
Yeah, this is an Urdu. Yeah, so the women ride one had gone up 40,000 or something. So this is an Urdu as well. So it is being successful, and I'm happy about one fact that my Urdu channel, because I'm not discouraging anyone to follow me, subscribe me, but a majority of my subscribers on my English channel were actually Indians, but the bigger majority It's still the bigger majority is Indian, but the second biggest majority, very close second biggest majority, is Pakistani. So that's a very good sign that I see that, okay, people are people are coming back, and they're coming back for more. So I think it's very interesting time. So I mean, I would like to do more of that. And with Facebook, when they took me down, I was quite disappointed. In a rush, I moved to Gab, and then I heard about Gab a little bit more.
Why not? I know that people say that. Go ahead.
To be fair, I obviously don't know what the personal views of the founder are, but I'm made it quite clear. I made some posts. I don't get racially attacked by anyone. You know, like I'm speaking about pro-immigration, I'm talking about pro-LGBTQ and all that. There's only one person said that, I can't remember exactly what this... she was some Australian woman. She was actually Australian, ironically. And she said, well, Australia is for white Australians. I'm sorry, nothing personal, but you got to go. There was only one person out of I don't know, hundreds who had liked my comments and shared and commented. I was like, okay, well, that's not too bad. The problem is, he was not going to... He was on Facebook, that person, that girl would probably be taken off. But he's saying, I'm not going to take her off, but I'm not going to take you off either. I think that's okay. I've always stood by the belief that let stupid people say the stupid things, and that just gives you an opportunity to prove them wrong and make fun of them.
Yeah. I think, when you went on Gab, I was hearing from it. And I think the Gab people themselves responded. This is one thing that happens, the thing is, they're banning a lot of the sort of the far right nut jobs, and I do think that they're nut jobs. I just don't think they should be banned. I think it's just like, you know, your Alex Joneses and the Milo Yiannopoulos, all of these guys are being taken off of social media. So Gab is one place that says, okay, the only time we're going to ever censor you is if you have threats to violence, if you incite violence.
And I think that's a good line to draw.
I don't know enough about them to know if they actually follow through with that. I would like to see, if I go on there and if I find that there are jihadists there that are talking about an Islamic caliphate, but they're saying we can't do it through violence. And if they don't... I would be happy to see that these guys also have a platform there. I want those people to come out. I want to see this stuff. I am not one of those guys who sees Twitter and says, oh my God, look at the discourse. I need to disconnect from this and go on a retreat for 2 weeks. I'm on a retreat every day. I don't spend my entire time on Twitter getting emotionally upset because of what I enjoy. Stuff.
The problem is, I mean, it is definitely more complicated than that, because some people do create a bubble around them, and they live in that. And we have seen the rise of anti-vaxxers and the flat earthers and all that. And we've seen that. But I think this is why it's just never in the good interest to shut people down. I think let's have a little bit of faith in the human discourse. I mean, historically speaking, we've fluctuated. We've gone up and down. But we are better off what we were 50 years ago and 2,000 years ago.
We're
constantly making progress, and there is an auto correction process. For some weird odd reason, how our morality evolved, but for some weird odd reason, it just auto corrects the bad bits out of it. So I don't know. Let's have a little bit of faith in human intellect.
It's a new technology. This kind of thing has happened before. It happened with the printing press.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of stuff. People were very, very upset about it. Yeah. People manipulated it. They used it for all kinds of things. I mean, there was a sort of loss of control.
People wanted to control. They wanted to just print out Bibles, and they didn't want to print out all the critiques of that. So it's always been interesting where people, one particular group, wants to take control of that. I think you wanted to talk about our coming event or something.
I do. So let's close on that. We have an event happening in Amsterdam. It's happening this weekend, so I think this will come out before August 31st. So it's happening on August 31st and September 1st. Both Harris and I will be there. Other Mariam Namazi is going to be there. Armin Navabi is going to be there. Mohammed Hisham is going to be there. Zara K. Pretty much it'll be like a secular jihadist alumnus reunion in a
reason,
way.
Reason on faith is Sohail.
Reason on faith, yes. Sohail's going to be here, and he's where I am too, right? Like we both kind of live in the same place. So we're I'm totally forgetting all these names. Mohammed Sayed, Sarah Haider, like the rock stars, right? The XMNA.
My hero Mohammed Sayed. He helped me restore my Facebook account. Wow, let's hope it does get fully restored. But and I'm speaking on a topic of identity politics and just on identity in our discourse. I've been thinking a lot about it, and it's so much so that I actually managed to think that on my next book that I just wanted to tell you that I'm writing my next book, and I've thought of I could write a whole chapter into it. So what I'll be speaking about it. It's quite interesting. I think we're speaking that for a couple of hours. I'll have other panelists with me as well, and I think it's going to be quite interesting. And after that, I am going to Berlin. I think Armin Nawabi is going to be there. I don't think that's been advertised yet for some reason, or maybe it has been.
I think I've seen it. Is Mohammed Hisham also on that? I think
Mohammed Hisham is going to be there. Yeah, that's why I said I'm going to meet him there. Mohammed Hisham is going to be there. Amin is going to be there. Valid from V2V is going to be there, and Marwa Mimzi, she's going to be there as well, who also happens to be his wife. So that's going to be fairly good. And then my last talk is in Oslo. It's just me. We're in association with Council of Ex-Muslims in Norway. Do check out that page, like that page. And if you are in Oslo, it'd be awesome if you come down. We can obviously hang out and speak a lot about this issue. So the next couple of weeks are very interesting. And then I'm off for a holiday for the following 2 weeks, just in Europe.
Nice. And what I'm doing is I'm going to be at the same conference as Haris is talking about. It's called Celebrating Dissent, the one in Amsterdam. And I am going to be on a panel with Armin. So Armin and I are both going to be joining a stand-up comedian and a columnist named Shabana Rahman, who is going to do. So and our panel is called Comedy, the Sacred, and Islamophobia. So we're going to be talking about the importance of comedy and satire when it comes to religion and criticizing religion.
Are we going to see that hidden comedian in you there as well? Are you going to do a stand-up gig as well?
No comment.
You're just gonna talk. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I know you won't let us down. I'm just worried about Armin.
Armin's a more serious one. I'm the more goofy one. So that's why we make such a good team.
I've noticed. Like I met him once when he came down here in Melbourne for a talk. Sometimes he doesn't get the joke. He's just too focused.
He's a very, very hyper-rational guy, and that's why. I mean, that's the thing. He does get jokes. I did
manage to change his opinion on one thing in our little car ride. When I was driving the car, he was sitting in the back seat.
That's why you changed his opinion, because you were driving the car and he was sitting in the back seat. He's like, "What the fuck, this guy's." It's like when you're in an Uber or a taxi, and the driver is like this. This like hyper mullah Islamic. He's like, "So you know, you're a Muslim. Where are you from?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I am. I am a Muslim because we're going like 120 on this highway, and I don't. Yeah. There's no way out of here. So, yeah, kind of thing." Yeah. Armin doesn't do that, by the way. He argues with them. He says no. I don't do it out of fear. I just don't want to bother. I don't want to fucking talk to my drivers. But
I had a very interesting. On a very quick note, as we're leaving, I had a very interesting conversation with a young Albanian Muslim, the Uber driver. And when I got in the car and he started praying, like you were just saying something in his mouth, I said, what are you doing? He said, "I'm praying, my brother." And he was 19-year-old Muslim. And then I just got into a conversation. I had to give it to him. And then I gave him some horrible hadiths and child marriage of Aisha and everything. I said, "Look it up." He was so young and stupid in a way that he said, are you shooting with me, bro?" Or like most of it was just news to him, and it was just a classic example of this kid who's just grown up in a man's body. He's 19-year-old and he's been told that this is what you do. And anyway, I just did it.
You've probably done that. I've actually converted a couple of young Uber drivers, because when my book came out, I was traveling for it, right? So I was like going all over the place.
Get my copy.
Huh?
You were handing out your copies to them? Just here, read
well,
it.
Well, no. I mean, I had my... So I'd be, like, looking at the book for the talk, and it's just a very prominent cover. It says The Atheist Muslim, and it just... Yeah. It just gets a reaction. It gets some kind of reaction out of everybody. So I'm like... I'll make notes on it. Sometimes I do it on purpose, but she was like a sort of a Muslim or a brown guy or something. And they would look at it. And, or, you know, when you go to the airport, they're like, where are you going? And like, I'm, you know, going. Then you start getting into it. And then I tell them, you know, I wrote a book. Like, what's a book? And I tell them what the book is. And then they write it down. I put it in their phone. So that happened. And there was a lot of, I was amazed at how pleasant, like they, when you sit down and you talk to them, especially when you come from a Muslim background, when you come from a Muslim background yourself,
we
and you bond on it.
Yeah. We also know the little trigger moments. We also know the little trigger moments. And this is why I say, well, you know, some people go really harsh on that. But some Westerner probably doesn't get it when a Westerner would say, well, if he married a 9-year-old girl, he's a pedophile. So he's like, yeah, I'm a pedophile. But we know that's not the way to approach a conversation.
Yeah.
You know exactly what would piss them off. You can criticize Allah, but you can't really criticize Muhammad. So there are ways around it.
There are ways around it. So, you know, the way that we talk here on the podcast is different from the way we're going to talk on social media when we're just talking about ideas to a general audience. It's going to be different from the way that I'd write an article. It's going to be different in when I write a book. But when I'm speaking to somebody one-on-one, it's a very, very different dynamic, right? It's completely
uncle or an
different.
Auntie or an uncle or an auntie or a cousin.
Yeah, yeah, a cousin, anything, or a kid or somebody younger. I generally end up speaking to people a lot younger. So, you know, they'd ask me about it, and I would tell them what it's about, and I just kind of give them the minimal, because the book is so obvious, and there's all the stuff in the book. I just give them. I'm like, you know, I just kind of changed my mind. You know, like what Noura and Bobby told that little girl.
Yeah,
I just changed my mind. This is what I think. And then when they ask about it, they ask. And then I'll tell them, I'm like, yeah, there was this, you know, I grew up like you, you know, I used to fast and all that stuff. I still kind of, I love the iftars. I just have a beer with them and, you know, things like that. I joke around. And when they see that there's a commonality and you bond on the identity, then they know that if I criticize his ideas or attack his ideas or beliefs, it's not personal. Because personally, I came from the same place. And I talk about that as an approach. I'm like, if you forge a bond on identity, and you lock that in. And then after that, when you talk about ideas, in my case, like the vast majority of people have been responsive to it, no matter how religious they were. But we had Sam Harris on the show some time ago, and he brought up a good point. He's like, that's not really scalable. He's like, you could do that, but that's not something I could do. And which is true. And so that's why I told him, I was like, just keep supporting us. I'll tell him to go to Harris's Patreon. Like, if you want to do it, maybe that you can make it scalable that way.
But I don't think he's on Patreon anymore. But on a very quick note, I just want to also say to your audience what I'm doing, and this is what a lot of my patrons are actually Westerners, and I've been really a bit lazy with my English language work because, as I said, I got to do more Urdu videos. I want to focus more on that because that's where we should be changing hearts and minds. And you guys are obviously producing a lot of content in English. There's plenty. So we should be focusing more on Urdu, but again, it takes resources. So I have managed to, I think my book is being translated in Urdu, which should be out by December. So we're obviously planning to give it out for free. I mean, everyone who sends me a message from Pakistan or India, because they can't afford a $20 book, so I just send them a free PDF. So, but the book will now be translated in Urdu as well and Hindi as well. The two volunteers from India also can... translating that, and we're expecting them to be translated by December, and hopefully, you know, we'll be able to connect with a lot more people. So that's an update on that. And if you are and you know, I'm assuming your audience are probably pretty educated on Islam as well, so you might find some arguments that are probably new in my book and some information that we've already touched on, so I don't know, you might like it. So get my book.
It is, and I'll say this again, it's a really, really good book, and it's fantastic, and there's very few books like this that are out there. You know, recently Yasmin Muhammad's book, Unveiled, is coming out in October as well, so I'm glad to see there are more books like this coming out. I think we need to start translating them into Urdu. I have seen an Indonesian, I've seen these unofficial translations. My one regret, Harris, about going with like a big publisher, like a mainstream publisher, is that I can't do what you do, which is to send out free PDFs.
Or and this is a hint, or I can't say.
Yeah.
So I send out free PDFs. That's the problem. I just can't say openly that I send out free, or that I would want. Well, yeah, I mean, whoever wants to hear you this can hear it. Anyway,
yeah.
Feel free to message me or whatever. But in any case, thank you very much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. This was awesome.
Thank you very much for having me. I think I've been twice now, so this is like Secular Jihad is like a benchmark for ex-Muslim speakers. So it's like, okay, I've been twice on it, so I'm in a league above all the ones who've been it only just once. You know, this pesky little.
I love it, and I think it was really fun to geek out on the whole Pakistan thing. But I mean, that article I think is very significant. Both of the things that we discussed about the rise of atheism there and the crackdown on atheists in Pakistan and why that's happening. I just think that there's a silver lining. When you look at these things, these bad news stories coming out of Pakistan, crackdown on atheists, people taking out secular bloggers and torturing them. It's horrific, horrific, horrific. But it is the effect of something. It's the effect that there's a realization that they need to do something about a phenomenon that is very real, that's happening, that they see as a threat. And that's the silver lining. And that's, I think, the real take-home message from all this. And
I agree.
And keep doing what you do, because another thing is, I was talking to some this guy I know, he's the son of an imam here. I can't say his name. He comes around and hangs out with me sometimes, and he's a hafiz of Quran. Like, he has a Quran memorized.
You've already given out a lot, and people would be asking, well, that imam's son is a hafiz. That imam's son is a hafiz.
Yeah, that really narrows it down.
It does.
I called you hafiz. I mean, Harris. Like, how many imam's sons could possibly be hafizes? So, and hafiz means that he's got the whole Quran memorized. Anyway, this guy. So he was telling me, he turned me on to a lot of the Arabic YouTubers. Some of them actually have subtitles, like Sharif Geber and everything, but there are other ones. And I see the same kind of thing with your channel, is that you're not burdened. When you do this stuff in English, you're conscious of your audience. You're conscious of that there's a regressive left that's going to opportunistically try to use your message the way that they want. You're conscious that there is a far right that is going to try to opportunistically use your message the way that they want. And you don't want to empower like the far right, anti-Muslim bigots. You're conscious of these things when you're doing this stuff in English. But I think when you're doing it in Urdu or when you're doing it in Arabic, you can just really speak openly. And that's what I really love about.
It's a very different kind of
it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's as in you can.
I would rather have a far left-wing, snowflake, tree-hugging person, you know, than a jihadi who's going to listen to my video.
Right.
Outright blasphemy. So in my English.
No, but video, that's the reason we're doing it, though.
True. I'd still like to have my head on my shoulders.
You want to have your, but what I mean is that you can go no holds barred and you can talk about the topic. You can talk about Islam. You can talk about the issues with it without thinking, okay, is somebody going to see this as an anti-Muslim? Without, I mean, people are conscious about that. I know a lot of ex-Muslims here in the West who are conscious about the way that they speak, because they're like, okay, is some Trump person going to use this opportunistically to say, hey, look, you know, there's a brown guy and he's Muslim and he hates the Muslims too. Or how are they going to use it? And that kind of thing is, with the Arabic YouTube, I've noticed they're not burdened.
It has pros and cons, I think it has a different kind of burden, but I see
of course.
Your point. It's
Oh, yeah, of course. Like, the jihadist coming after you and trying to behead you is obviously another kind of burden.
And a lot more worrisome things. Yeah.
I acknowledged. Okay, fair point. But still, I just really like, there's something I like about listening to stuff in Urdu and in Arabic, because I really feel like it's totally on topic in that sense. Just conversationally, it's not, there isn't a conversational burden in the same way, you know, like that conceptual. Anyway, okay, taking up a lot of your time. Thank you very much. And I'll see you this weekend, I guess, in just a couple of days.
Yeah, couple of days,
I'm
really looking forward to meeting all of you.
All right, so I'm gonna say goodbye to the audience, all you guys. Bye, Harris, to stay on. I just want to talk about the Amsterdam for a little bit. So, everybody, thank you for joining us. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you soon next time. Thank you. So,
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.